Welcome, movie fans. Thanks for joining us for episode 88 of Reading Between the Reels, the premier podcast of Thousand Yard Stares. If you're a new listener, we're so glad you found us. If you've been enjoying the show, please tell someone about us. Post on X or Facebook, write a review on your favorite podcast catcher, or just recommend the show to a friend. I'm Craig Dickinson, and I'm joined as always by my co-hosts Corey Hatchmidt and Justin Olin. What's up, fellas? How are we doing tonight?
Absolutely fantastic. I got nothing for this. I was trying to think of something. How do I put something on this movie? I don't know. I've got no intro other than to say, here's Justin.
Thank you for that wonderful intro, Corey. it's hard to make jokes when we're talking about this movie, but hello.
Yeah. And we're also joined tonight by returning guest and host of Force Ghost Conversations, Anthony King. Welcome back, Anthony.
Theory will only take you so far, fellas, so let's get into this movie and discuss it at length. I hope to be here for as long as the movie itself, so let's shoot for over 3 hours.
Buckle up, people.
Buckle up.
So we were talking a little bit before we started recording that we've had some different experience levels with this film. And so I've seen it 4 times. Anthony, you said you'd seen it 4, maybe 5, if we count the TikTok videos. Justin, where are you at?
Well, I have a full-time job, so I was at 1.5.
Okay.
It's a long movie.
Corey, you've done the 1 time so far.
I just watched it Monday, so 2 days ago.
Okay.
First time.
There you go. So we're just going to go ahead and jump into overall thoughts. I'm going to start with Corey. We'll work our way up. First-time viewer. So.
Oh, man. All right. Now, listen. I do not have the experience with this movie that you guys do. I did not watch it till Monday. I fully intended to watch this movie in the theater. I heard the hype. I saw the TikTok clips and I thought, oh man, this movie looks like something I'd be interested in. I love the concept. I love the topic. I love this historical type thing where it's a little bit of documentary. Fun fact, I've also been to the Nevada test site where they let off nuclear bombs, 14 nuclear bombs, where I was doing some work for a week as an intern. And, so it is something that I really appreciate, especially when they talk about Hanford out here and they talk about different parts for getting ready for this bomb and people watching it when it goes off. And I sat in some of those chairs for the ones that were at Nevada test site. It was kind of there's a realism there that I appreciated. For me, it's a long, slow movie. I guess the way that I heard it described was this was a documentary thriller or what was the I can't remember what it was. And at first I thought, I don't know how to describe it that way, but it's a good movie. It's long, it's slow. I didn't really jump into the intensity of it until the ending, because then I saw a little bit more about Oppenheimer. And that's the part I appreciate. After the bomb, I look at the clock and there's an hour left of movie. And I'm thinking, my gosh. We just made the bomb. What else are we going to do? And then seeing his life afterwards and what became of it and Strauss and Oppenheimer. Then I was like, okay, now here's the story. So really, I don't know if I could watch this movie again because it's kind of painful. I mean, not all the parts are painful, but some parts are, to where I'm like, it's a little slow and building. And I think the intensity with Matt Damon is there, the scene with the explosion, and then afterwards – the last hour is the part that I enjoyed.
Okay. And it's pronounced Strauss.
Strauss. Yeah. Strauss.
Justin?
I absolutely loved it. I'm a history teacher because I like history, not for any other reason. So, I thought it was fantastic. I even remember, like, as a little kid, maybe in, like, elementary school or early middle school. I can't recall, but I remember – like having a unit on the making of the bomb and like Oppenheimer when I was in class. And I was always just very interested in like the Manhattan Project. It was always something like, I don't know a ton about it, but I know a fair amount. And it always just like caught my imagination. And I always thought it was really cool. And I've read a book or two about it, and I haven't read the book that this movie's based on, but the way it's portrayed, the way it's visualized, the way that Oppenheimer is visualized with all of his mannerisms and everything, I was really captivated. The political side of things, I was like the political chess matches that they're playing, I didn't love as much as I thought I was going to. It was still interesting, but I'm not as familiar with that historical side of it, so maybe that's why I wasn't as captivated. But overall, I mean, it's a Christopher Nolan movie, and like Christopher Nolan, I can't think of a movie of his I don't enjoy. And the way the story is told between, you know, jumping back and forth in time, at first it was just because there are so many characters to kind of get down and understand. It was a lot, but once you sunk into the movie, I appreciated that style of storytelling, and we'll probably get more into that later in the podcast. But I loved it. It was great. I'm definitely going to watch it a second time fully and not just clips. It took me, so I would have watched it sooner, but my wife does this thing where she's like, oh, I want to watch this movie with you too. But so if my wife says she wants to watch the movie, I have to wait for her, and then I have to wait a really long time, and I don't get to watch it whenever I want. So it was great. I wish I could have watched it more before our podcast.
Anthony?
Yeah, so I absolutely adore this movie, everything about it. This has projected itself into easily one of my favorite films of all time.
Oh.
Not only was it an event viewing for me personally, but I feel like this movie is one of those pieces of art that transcends art itself, and it helps to inspire debate and conversation about the themes surrounding both Oppenheimer, the choice to create the atomic bomb and to use the atomic bomb, the aftermath of such a choice. And it's always important to have those conversations, even in the post-World War II world that we live in. I mean, we're almost 80 years since the droppings of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, you know, this film is going to be one of those films that it's going to be, I think, a seminal piece of film culture. But I think more so than that, it's going to be something that is going to be a part of world culture and debate that I think will help to inspire future conversations and the concept of the push-pull between science and discovery versus what are the ramifications of such a discovery. All that stuff kind of comes to the forefront as a result of this movie. And I think that just for the movie itself, I mean, this is Nolan. I don't want to say it's his magnum opus, but because, you know, once you've done your best, what's the point of doing anything after? So I hope that he continues to make movies after this. But I think this is, for me at least, this is his gold standard of this is what you should be trying to shoot for and trying to excel beyond. This is a 3-hour movie with primarily dialogue centered around science, and not just science, but nuclear physics, right? It's a it's a really hard topic to condense into just a film that people can, just the general public can get excited about. I mean, this thing almost made $1 billion at the box office, right? That people can go in and sit in and, you know, for the most part, not be bored or, you know, start thinking about anything else, right? With the way attention spans are these days. It takes a very special film. It takes a very special cast. The cast is operating at 110% efficiency, if you ask me. The effects are fantastic. The cinematography is probably some of the best work I've ever seen from a Nolan film. The score is astounding. We'll, of course, get into all those different aspects throughout this podcast. But, you know, this is a film that, like I said before, was event viewing for me. I went to school for history myself. So, you know, this was something that, and a story that I've been intimately aware of for, you know, since I was 8. I want to point out that, you know, for the viewers, listeners at home, of course, this isn't a visual podcast. So excuse me for pointing this out to the gentleman on the call here, but you may see this picture in the back here that I'm pointing at. And that is a signed picture that I have of the Enola Gay crew, signed by Paul Tibbetts, the pilot of the Enola Gay, as well as the navigator Dutch van Kirk. So I met those guys in 2006 at a World War II kind of convention that we had in my hometown. And I literally saw into their eyes, right, the degree of separation between people that have seen the atomic bomb actually dropped and the mushroom cloud and the aftermath of all that. Like, I've looked into the eyes of men that have actually seen it firsthand. And, you know, that's so powerful to begin with. I've seen the Enola Gay itself, the plane. It's at the National Air and Space Museum outside of Washington, D.C. So like this, these are important conversations and discussions to have that I think that only a film that's made this well can achieve, right? If we're talking about like how bad the CG is, that dominates the conversation more so than the actual themes and the takeaways of the film overall. So the fact that the film is just operating on absolutely every cylinder possible, it allows us to have these great debates and conversations that will linger on into the future. So those are my overall thoughts right now.
I think kind of to go off of what you said about that, it's so important too that these historical films are done well, because a lot of people are going to remember this historical event from this movie, not from a book, not from living through it. It's going to be from the movie. I mean, for better or for worse, I feel like a lot of people's perception of what happened at and around Pearl Harbor is kind of the same thing. Like, that movie is riddled with historical inaccuracies, but that's kind of what's going to go down in a lot of people's memories. So it's good that they did such a excellent and careful job on this one. Like, they took care to do it right.
And I see that. I think it's great. I think it's fantastic. I agree there. I think two things. One, I think I do need more viewings of it, but it's an investment to watch that much.
Yeah.
There's an emotional investment to watching a movie like this, because you realize, and maybe it's our generation that knows and has seen and met people who've been in that generation around that time, to know the pressure and the time and the crunch and the push and the fight to get every scrap and scientist going. And so there's an investment of emotions to watch an epic biographical thriller. That's what I found the term, biographical thriller like this. And I think that's what it is. And the other part I think is I did not watch it in the theater. And that is a problem for a movie that's epic like this for the first viewing. I think I should have watched this in the theater, because then you're locked in. Otherwise, I've got my phone in my hand. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing other things. I'm taking notes for the podcast. I'm distracted a little bit in what I'm doing. And that brings in a little bit of lull in some of the spots that in the theater you wouldn't notice.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add to what you guys have seen. But Corey, I would encourage you to rewatch it. And every other time I've rewatched it since the theater experience, I've watched it with the subtitles on. And I know I said this a lot last time when we were talking about Dune, but I think it really helps the movie quite a bit. It's such a smart film. And as much as it's kind of slow in that things are not happening quickly, the dialogue is quick and it's explaining things that are getting paid off later. And with all of the characters, so many characters that are important being referenced in the film, we'll talk about this a little bit, how the editing helps with that. But getting to know who all these people are helps you get invested in the story. And it just completes that experience. It definitely, in my opinion, demands a rewatch, as does basically everything Christopher Nolan's ever put out.
Yeah.
But I've enjoyed it. Every time I've watched it, I've enjoyed it a little bit more, because I feel like I'm understanding the story and who the characters are and the motivations a little bit more.
I was a little frustrated on my watching. So it's currently on Peacock, and I watched it on Peacock. And for whatever reason, maybe it's my TV, maybe it's Roku, I don't know what it is. It's not consistent with the subtitles. You can add subtitles and a few minutes later, it'll kick them off. So I can't be like, I'll my subtitles. It's very quick. And I got much more out of it in the scenes that the subtitles were showing.
Well, interestingly about that too, I mean, this was a thing where it kind of, again, Nolan is such a trendsetter that this basically kind of brought back from the dead physical media in a lot of ways. Like the 4K and the Blu-ray disc sold out for this film. Like I remember I went to go, I couldn't get it right away. Which was kind of amazing. And so you're going to get a better, I'm just one of those guys. I'm going to say this. I'm a cinephile. Watching the 4K physical disc is better than watching it streaming. It just is. It's a higher quality picture and sound. And you're not going to have issues with streaming subtitles, obviously. So that's my plug for that. Yes, it's on Peacock. Absolutely watch this film, but it's definitely a movie that you should purchase. And Nolan's also been a record. Like, they're not going to change it. Once it's physically, they can't change it. So this movie, as great as it is, will not be.
What do you mean they can't change it?
Well, in streaming, they can edit stuff, Corey.
Well, I'm gonna tell you right now, if you change just a couple scenes in this movie, you'd be able to show it in schools.
That's true.
It's show it the way it is right now.
The Florence Pugh stuff.
I'm just saying, When you said it sold out in a few hours, I was like, Craig, was that the bomb or was that Force View? What's the reasoning here? But yeah. No, I think if you honestly, if you took that whole scene out, all of that stuff with her out and kind of set that aside, or mm-hmm. I mean, that part.
Yeah.
You could show this in a high school. You could show this in a high school for history class.
A lot of this, I was
so frustrated by those Florence Pugh scenes, because it's like it doesn't enhance the story. In fact, I feel like it even takes away from the story. It's completely unnecessary. Like, I don't know. It was kind of frustrating. And it's not really Nolan's thing. Like, I can't think of when he does that.
It's not. It's really the only other than Insomnia, it's the only other movie that has any nudity at all. But I would say that I understand a little bit more why it's there on subsequent viewings, just because of how, and I've heard Nolan's interviews about this too, about how important Jean Tatlock was and how obsessed he was with her, and why that's important with the follow up in the end with the security clearance hearing and all of that stuff. Yeah, could it have been handled in a different way? Yes, I would say so. I think you could have done it in a more subtle way without having complete nudity, but you know, it's a nitpick for me. Anywho, speaking of images, look at that segue. cinematography. So composition, color, camera work. I'm going to start with you, Anthony, and then we'll go Justin and Corey, then me.
I will say, I don't know how this appeared on streaming, but I know, Craig, you and I watching the 4K, we got the IMAX scenes. You could tell with the aspect ratio is changing. And usually for those wide shots of the what was supposed to be Nevada, those were just breathtaking. Some really beautiful work on that front in terms of just, you know, the color of the desert at nighttime. It really helped, in my opinion, to add to the beauty of it, because you really had to convey how much Robert really loved Nevada. Like, even just in my learnings about the man himself, like, this, it wasn't a joke that this man really loved that state and wanted to spend as much time there as possible. So that was really good. So anything that is an IMAX scene automatically just like stands out in my brain. Those were just some really epic scenes there. And especially like that, can you hear the music montage in the beginning of the movie, with especially the mix of like the atoms breaking and all that work in there, they just interfuse in there. It's just really added to an interesting and great viewing experience for me and every time I watch it.
Justin, you were going to say something.
Oh, yeah. So that's good to hear from Anthony, because I almost assumed, based on what I knew of Oppenheimer and why they chose Los Alamos, I thought the love of New Mexico was overplayed, but it sounds like not so much.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's good to know. Okay. I like the movie a little more now.
There you go. Anthony, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about image-wise? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it kind of gets into kind of just the production value of it all. But it just, what was presented on screen just felt very 1940s-esque. I said I've been to a couple World War II reenactments in my lifetime. There is just a visual sight that I think that they captured excellently of the 1940s in this film. And it was almost to the point where all of my senses were engaged just by seeing this imagery. So, I mean, this may sound weird, but there's a smell to World War II, if you ask me. Like, if you, like, go to an army surplus store and you come across some, like, World War II jackets, like, there's a smell on them. And probably it's the oil crude and all that stuff from 70 years just kind of resonating on it and all that. But if you go to a convention or a World War II reenactment, you'll certainly, there's a distinct smell that I was certainly smelling while watching this movie, which is an odd thing to say, but it just goes to showcase how wonderful this piece of art is, that if I'm engaged in all five senses, like, this is a transcendery experience, if you ask me.
Justin, what about you? Your observations for cinematography.
Oh, I'm just thinking about the smell of World War II now. Like, I immediately just thought,
I know.
Like, honestly, in my mind, the smell of World War II is my grandpa, because he's kind of that age, and he still very much dresses like some of the men in here, like with the really high waisted pants and things like that. High waisted
pants and the short tie.
Yeah, like, yeah. I kind of want that to come back. It's not a bad look. No, in terms of cinematography, like you said, Anthony, like you got those really wide shots that kind of just show you the scale of everything and just exactly how remote Los Alamos was and is, I guess. Well, not as much as it used to be, but and then that's interspersed of like moments of extreme stress and like extreme close-up shots of Oppenheimer, who Cillian Murphy just does a fantastic job of showing how much pressure that guy was under. He looks like he needs a nap or something. But yeah, you just intersperse that with the close-up shots, and like there was a lot of, I don't know what else to call it, not shaky cam in the traditional sense, like during a fight scene we usually call that as shaky cam. I guess like a handheld camera, like it is a little bit rougher, and that adds quite a bit of tension to the scene. At first it grew on me, but at first I was not a fan of the switching off between color and black and white. And I couldn't figure out, it was a good 30 minutes before I'm just like, all right, why are some of these scenes black and white? And I, from what I understand, it's any scene that's from Strauss's point of view is black
and
white.
Or just not Oppenheimer's point of view.
Oppenheimer's color.
or not. Okay. Not Oppenheimer. So I ended up liking that quite a bit. I think it added like a weight to the film a little bit. I think we are like mentally trained to view black and white as like seriousness, because serious movies you watched as a kid were always black and white, because that's, you know, that's documentaries, that's older movies, stuff like that. So it adds like a weight to the scenes. And then this is not my idea, I stole it from somebody, but somebody had mentioned that the idea that his scenes, Strauss's scenes, they are in black and white because it conveys like how he views the world. Whereas Oppenheimer is more vibrant and sees like kind of all the colors of the spectrum and sees ups and downs and wrong versus right, where Strauss is just completely black and white. Is it a net benefit or a net loss? And that's it. And with that in mind, I didn't hear that theory until after I watched the movie. But that in mind, I'm like, I gotta go back. Gotta go back and watch that. Anyway, so just fantastic. I mean, the cinematography makes the film. It is a beautiful film. It's not a very fast film, so it has to be beautiful. Like, it has to be enjoyable to watch. And Anthony, like you said, I mean, nail on the head, with the exception of smell, it engaged 4 out of 5 of my senses, because it's just, you're immersed, and I wasn't even watching an IMAX.
Corey, what about you? Cinematography observations.
So I got a couple, though. I think the bomb scene is absolutely brilliant. And people who watched it in the theater must have had sunburns. I mean, it was amazing. I love that's not a CGI shot. It's not fake. They really blew something up. I mean, it probably is close to a nuclear explosion that you can get without actually going nuclear, from what I hear. But to see the shots and the flame, and to almost, how do you describe this? It's almost like Nolan fell in love with the flame and showed it to you. Like, he had a close-up shot, and then he pans back and you see the mushroom, and then you go back in, and then you come back out. Like, and it's just this appreciation of this explosion, and dead silent, absolute silence in the movie. And then you hear him breathing. I mean, what do you say about that? I mean, what movies do you know can pull off absolute silence and make you go, yeah, I'm still here and I'm captivated? Like, you don't think something just went wrong, you know? And I mean, he pulls that off incredibly. That whole scene is beautiful. And his quote about becoming death, destroyer of worlds, and then the explosion. And that works for me, the way he does that scene, the whole color of it, the camera work of it in and out on the explosion, giving us a close-up view and a backup view, the flash, everything.
Does anyone else get goosebumps every time they hear that line? Now I am become death, that one.
I mean, it's powerful. It's the legacy of this character.
Every single time, it's like chilling.
I mean, what a great way to subvert the expectations too, right? Everyone coming into this movie is like, you're looking for that scene where the test, or at least a bomb, explodes, right? And they're building up to it, and then as soon as you see the detonation, it's just dead silent. Like, complete 360, 180, whatever you want to call it, from what people were expecting, and then to just hit them with the wall of sound.
Yeah, well, I love how the silence was punctuated with that quote. Like, yeah. I think that quote is what breaks the silence. And
he says it earlier fantastic. In the movie, too.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, with Florence Pugh.
Yeah, that's the first instance.
I'm going to be honest.
I remember that scene quite well. I'm pretty sure he said that.
I skipped those scenes, and there were a couple times where I'm like, I probably should have watched that. I don't know what's happening.
So I think the thing about it is I'm going to say this is the part of the movie that I come to enjoy. This is from the bomb forward. And a little bit before that, but like the last hour and a half, I guess. Because there's an intensity. I've always known about Oppenheimer. I teach science. He's been on one of my Bellwork entry task quotes, the death become destroyer of worlds, what that meant. For the last couple of years, I've had it on there. And I had no idea this movie was coming out. And so I've known who he was. I've known about him. I didn't realize all the extra stuff afterwards. I never knew that. And so this is where the biographical thriller part of it comes in. The dirtiness of Hollywood and the world and that doggone Strauss. You know, all of that.
It's pronounced Strauss.
I think that's where it brings it in at the end. And the color and the way he does the camera and the work back in black and white and color through there for the rest of the movie works. A lot of cut scenes. The one thing I did notice that was kind of nice, I didn't pay attention before. Most of the time when you're on a train and stuff, it's you kind of have a still camera and stuff. And when they're on the train, it's rocking. The camera is rocking with the, like as a train would, not just shaking, but rocking in time with the camera, with the sound. And I thought that was kind of a nice move. And then the part, this is the only other thing I got to point out about camera work. When they're outside, they always moved somewhere to have their conversation, to have a talk. So like they'd pull up. Nolan does these big sweeping shots. It's almost like you can tell the camera's on a boom or a drone or some kind of a track. So it's always smooth. And he pans along and then goes and zooms into the person and then they have their conversation. Or this car pulls up, the guy gets out and they walk along and then the mark is over here where you're going to engage in your conversation. And they go over to that spot and the camera's panning in a smooth motion with it. Or it's on a track where it goes and then it settles in and turns. And so I think Nolan does that a lot in this movie for the outside shots. And then there's other times where he's just straight cutaway, like kind of like what we see here, just a cutaway and we're sitting there and the camera's on a tripod somewhere. So it's a little bit different, I think. And I like the sweeping motion because it sets the scene outside. It lets you see them have to move. A lot of it, though, I thought was because of the security wise. You know, a lot of times back then they had a conversation and this guy can listen to this conversation. This guy can't. And so they had to walk someplace where, okay, let's go have a talk over here so we can, okay, well, I need this guy to do this and, you know, what they're working on. And so in my mind, at that time, the secrets and the military aspect and security played a role into all of that stuff. And I think Nolan hit it well with the camera work.
Corey, I think you're liking this movie the more and more you talk about it.
Listen. Honestly, you think about how many movies you've ever watched that you didn't enjoy.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed this movie. I really did. I was just a little bored.
Yeah.
And I think I regret not watching it in the theater because I think had I done that, I probably would have been on the same boat with all of you. I really enjoyed the end of this movie. The end of this and from the bomb on, I think is a tremendous movie about who this man was and what he tried to undo. You think about the blood on his hands that he talks about and mentions in Truman's office, which is a fact. And it happened.
That did happen.
I mean, at that point, I go, "Oh my gosh, there is a realization of what he did," and yeah,
yeah. From what I understand, Oppenheimer was not a fan of Truman after that visit because he was not very kind to him. Just told him to man up.
He said, "Do not let this SOB into the White House ever again."
Yeah,
keep that crybaby out of here.
Yeah, they doctored that up a little bit for the movie. But, you know, I think you think about that. I mean, he was in such a push and a rush the whole first half of the movie to make this bomb. And then when he does it, it's like he spends the rest of the last hour of the movie kind of realizing what it is. And probably more than anyone, because when he hears – there's two times he cries. I'm going to point this out because this deals with camera work. There's only two times he cries in the movie that I saw. He cried – well, there's a couple. But, I mean, he cried – when the bomb went off and he walked outside and they were celebrating, everybody was celebrating because they had accomplished this, right? And they were right. He cried. And then he cried, he teared up when Truman's on the radio talking about dropping the bomb. Because I feel like that point, this is a man who not only knows the science of it, he knows the science of what those people who just died experienced from it and that he made it. And I feel like you couldn't help but imagine that. Like, oh my gosh, think about this. I know all the safety things that this is what's taking place. This many people died. This many people are about to die in a day. These are about to die in a week. These are about to die in a month. Like, you would know that more than anybody.
So many good things, guys. I'm going to just kind of add a little bit to things I noticed this time, I think, more than I had noticed before was, speaking of colors, I love that we talked about the black and the white. But I think also what's interesting is there's some great kind of golden, rich, warm tones in just about every Gene Tatlock scene there is, other than the suicide / possibly murder. So his memory, and that's, again, it's Oppenheimer seeing the world, right? It's his point of view. And it's also interesting, the first time he meets Kitty and starts to explain, you know, how atoms fit, makes it look like it's actually solid matter. That scene is, that's the only one, I think, with her that's very warm. But all the Gene Tatlock scenes are very warm, kind of golden, as opposed to, and then, because you see that with the editing, you see back to the security hearing, and it is cold and desaturated, and it feels very uncomfortable versus these other things. So seeing those two combined next to each other, I thought was just a brilliant masterstroke. And again, it's playing with my emotions, and I don't know why if I'm not paying attention, but now going back in, like, you're manipulating me. Nice job. Some other thing, the first shot of the film after we see there's the scripts of, you know, about Prometheus and whatnot. Mm-hmm. First shot on Oppenheimer's face and then the slow pullback is just so masterfully done. It's like, it's literally pulling us in as it's pulling back. Love that so much. Corey, you mentioned, whoever mentioned the handheld. There's a great instance of that. I think Justin, thank you. When Lawrence is telling Oppie that he's being followed because they think he's a communist, like that whole scene that they're standing in the classroom, it's all very handheld. It's very herky jerk. It's very chaotic. And it's kind of, it's like Oppenheimer's realizing, but it's also realizing that he's in trouble, but it's also kind of jarring. It's jarring for him. It's jarring for us. And then the last thing I wanted to point out was when he's addressing the crowd in the gym, and there's that changing depth of field in the background is so unnerving.
Yep.
It's so bizarre. And it's just like, it's clearly trying to get us to feel what he's feeling, but there's like this automatically, there's this disconnect between what he's saying and what he's feeling. That's how I took that.
I'm pretty sure we have that same weird, are you talking about like it's almost like the vibrating depth of field a little bit?
Yes.
It does that on the train as well. I noticed. And I think there was a third time too, and I don't have it here in my notes, but that was a neat effect that you don't often see in a, like, such a historical film. Like you see that in a
sci-fi film, maybe,
like sci-fi pretty regularly.
Yeah.
But I mean, this almost could be a sci-fi. It's real, but so much of what they're doing just seems foreign.
I would say half the movie almost is like the science that they're doing at the beginning is almost unheard of. Like when you start a whole physics program in the States, it basically is science fiction until it is a real thing.
I kept trying to like put myself in their place this entire movie. Like the amount of changes someone during this time would have lived through. I mean, if you were in your 50s or 60s at this time, you would have lived through World War I, which essentially started with horses, and up to this where you're dropping this type of weaponry. I mean, that's just got to be insane. The amount those people just had to digest mentally.
It's wild for those even just like if you're 20 in 1945. I mean, just think about most of the countries in the world, Germany, Soviet Union, Britain, they're all still using bolt action rifles as their main service weapon. They're not even up to semi-automatics like the US is. And we're dropping the greatest, most powerful weapon to ever be devised at that point in time.
Yeah.
it's just astounding.
Don't know how to wrap your head around. Just the juxtaposition of, I mean, the way they dress, like, we see that as like a such a way like old people dress nowadays with all the technology that, you know, even we don't even understand today. Most of the population has no clue what they're talking about, I'm sure. And myself included, I'm not bragging.
So my last thing that I want to say before we move to sound was, because it just occurred to me, is that effect of him in the gym talking reminded me of something that I couldn't remember what it was. And it's the Scarecrow scenes in Batman Begins. Oh. And it's Cillian Murphy again. Yeah. And I'm just like, thank you for the rhyming. It's like poetry. It rhymes. It's so good. Brilliant. So, sound. It's another thing it's nominated for. Multiple things. We'll talk about that at the end, because yeah, this is also our Oscar preview show. We didn't really talk about that, but that's coming up. So Anthony, I'm going to start with you. Sound effects, soundtrack, vocal sounds. What did you notice?
Wow, where to begin here? I mean, I'm going to probably use soundtrack for last, because I think Ludwig Göransson just really knocked out of the park. I mean, talk about something that is a way to also additionally move the story forward in a very engaging way when it's just a lot of dialogue going on. To create a montage scene of science happening, right? It's not very often that you can make that engaging, but with the right music in the background, anything is possible. I think the sound effects was really astounding, especially in this last viewing that I had at home, whereas especially after the bomb drops, you can kind of hear in the background a little bit of just like, I guess, just like the ticking sound of atoms. I don't know if you noticed this or if anyone else noticed this while you were listening, because I was just like, am I going crazy? Is my sound system off? And then I had to almost like play it on three different devices to see if I wasn't going crazy. But I was like, oh no, that's just subtly in the background there, just kind of going off. And I think just an epic way, you know, like we talked about, like this movie is centered around a bomb going off. Right. That Trinity test is what got people in the seats for this movie. And if that doesn't sound good, then people are going to walk out of this theater and go, well, that was underwhelming. So they had to recreate the sound and the sound waves and the shock waves, basically. I don't know how they did it. I wish I would have spent, I think there's, 3 hours of bonus features of the making of this movie on the 4K. Them all. And I wish I would have taken the deep dive in doing all this before, you know, coming into this conversation here. But I'm sure they explain how they did it in great detail in those documentary pieces, behind the scenes featurettes. But that was just so powerful. And again, to highlight that juxtaposition we talked about of the absence of sound almost there, like that's a brilliant choice in my opinion too. And then to just knock you off your socks. I can only imagine what those people that got those front row IMAX 70 millimeter seats in those select cities that got to have that format. They were sitting basically center row in the front of the movie, staring up at this behemoth of a wall, and only just to get knocked back by the sound that was assaulting them in a roundabout way. That was just really well done on all those fronts. I liked all the little testing explosions that they had to kind of precursor to like see if the explosion device, the detonation device that they're working on, I think it was called the Thin Man gun method detonation device, to see if that would even work. I mean, that's also great stuff. I love the sound. We've talked a little bit of that scene in the gym when he's announcing the devastation that was done in Hiroshima with the gymnasium, and it had that sound of a 1940s gym with the echoes all throughout, and just the constant rip roar of people stomping their feet onto these wooden bleachers, in a way, like that was really just powerful to me, to how it came across and making the story just more devastating in a way. Like you could feel the haunting nature of it come across even more. And I felt like the sound design too of this whole film just really added to that at various points in this. To Ludwig Göransson of it all, that last musical piece, Destroyer of Worlds, where he's talking to Einstein, kind of showcasing that point of view conversation versus what Strauss thought they were talking about him and going behind his back, when really they were talking about something a little bit more important. That was one of my top songs on Spotify this past year. And that was, I mean, it's just a brilliant, haunting piece that just showcases the weight and gravity of what that scene was requesting. I still listen to it a lot this day, and it's one of those songs that makes me, again, it brings up all those questions and thought pieces that I have about this movie, right? What are the lasting effects of this? What are the implications for the future? Because we have atomic devices now, we can't think of a world without them. We have to think of a world that now has them, and what can we do to ensure that an event like this never occurs again, right?
Yeah.
Those are the questions that come into mind when I hear these musical pieces. And again, that can you hear the music sequence? I watched like a 20-minute documentary on how he put that together, and I studied music also in my collegiate days, and I still don't really understand how he put that together. It's a lot of just overlapping pieces at different time signatures and a different styles to make it happen, and it's just, again, mind-boggling. Like I said, everybody that worked on this movie gave 130%, not even 110, 120. They were on their A game. And it just makes this movie all the better for that point. So those are all my thoughts on that one. Get the vinyl if you can. Another reason for physical media. Yeah.
Anthony, I didn't know that you had studied music in college. That makes so much sense. It's all coming together now.
It's all coming together. I was a radio DJ in college. That's how we got to this point.
Nice. Corey, why don't you go next? Your observations on sound.
You know, the thing about the soundtrack, I saw this quote. I was looking this up afterwards because I was watching the movie, and that Nolan had told Goranson to use the violin for the central theme. And Goranson remarked that he felt that the violin could go from the most romantic, beautiful tone in a split second to neurotic and heart-wrenching horror sounds. And I think when you think about all the scenes in this movie, that's a perfect description of why they would call it a biographical thriller, is that there is a buildup of music and intensity that sets the pace. Like, oh my gosh, this is a hurried pace. This is a hurried time trying to get to this bomb. Almost like a ticking, counting down, waiting for it to happen. You know, this explosion's coming. Everybody's told you about it. But it can be neurotic at the same time, because some of these guys were dealing with stuff that nobody had ever done, and pushing and pushing and pushing in a race against Russia, and a race against Germany, and all of these things, you know? So I think that's an amazing way to describe it. And that's from the guy who did it himself, Goranson. So the other part, I think, is the sound of doing it in silence, having some silent moments in there. That's a bold, brave thing to do, especially for an explosion. And to pull that off, Nolan's a genius. So that's all I got on sound.
Justin, what about you?
So, Craig, you know more about this stuff, so I got to ask a question before I start. So, as I was watching this movie, and maybe it's because it's directed by Christopher Nolan, and so is Interstellar, but a lot of it sounded very Interstellar-y to me. And I'm not good at the soundtrack stuff. That is not my forte. little soundtrack joke there. But it sounded very much like Interstellar, which is a different composer.
Yep.
So my question for you, Craig, is how much influence does a director have on the score? Like, how much are they, you know, buddy-buddy with the composer? Could he have influenced that to sound like Interstellar, or am I just crazy? Did it sound like that to anyone else?
I mean, I think it depends on the director. I know there's different – I'm pretty sure, like, if you're working with John Williams, they're pretty much just like, you just go do what you're going to do. I would not be surprised if Nolan said, hey, I kind of want something that sounds like this. I know that's a thing that happens too, where they play a piece of music, whether it's from one of their films or a different film. Say, I want something that feels like this.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't be surprised if that was a thing.
Because sometimes when I go into these movies, like, I did not look up the composer beforehand. I'm like, I'm gonna see if I can, like, tell what it is. And
yeah.
I was like positive Hans Zimmer, and turns out no.
Goranson's great too. Yeah, it's a seamless transition from going from Zimmer to Goranson when he started with Tenet, and it was just like, yeah,
oh, this see, guy I thought works that great was too. Zimmer too. See, I'm just an idiot.
No, Zimmer was doing Dune at the time, so
okay.
They complement each other brilliantly in my
opinion. Okay. So while I loved the score, like, score makes or breaks a film in almost every situation. It took me out of it just a little bit, because I kept getting drawn back to Interstellar and, like, the French horns and all that stuff going off in the background. But I absolutely loved it. I think on subsequent watches, I need to separate it in my mind a little bit more and notice differences, not similarities. Yeah, I don't know if I have a lot to say other than what you guys have already said. Like it was great. Yeah. I did notice like the constant ticking. I felt like every piece had some sort of like very subtle ticking. I mean, that's just music. There's going to be like a metronome in there somewhere at some point, but it added like a sense of worry, like a sense of impending doom in just about every single scene.
Yes. I don't have a ton to add. I mean, the stomping of the feet as an editing bridge, I thought was interesting to see that happen, which you also have the narration for vocal sounds, the narration of how the plan for Los Alamos as a editing bridge as well, where it's talking and then you start seeing things filling in. The editing is brilliant for this, and I know that's one thing it's got nominated for. Please, honestly, this is a great example of how to edit a film, especially a 3-hour film. Yeah, but I think the only other thing that I want to throw in is that I really liked, I thought was a really interesting choice, because no one can play around with music and dialogue sometimes in ways that are very non-traditional. I mean, I remember these as far back as even like Dark Knight Rises, like, well, and originally we weren't even supposed to understand Bane as much as we did. But at the end of the, we have the two hearings are basically happening at the same time. They're getting down to, we're going to get the results on Fusion and Vision at the same time. The music ramps up so loud there, it almost feels like they're in competition with each other. And it adds to the stress and the immersion of that for the audience. But it's really like, it is bordering on, I can't tell what they're saying.
You get that a lot in Interstellar too.
What an interesting choice. I didn't mind it. I didn't hate it, but it was like, okay, something really interesting is happening here.
There's a thing that really irritates me with TV manufacturers, and they will have different sound profiles that you can change on your TV. And so many times when I'm watching Christopher Nolan films, I assume my sound profile is wrong because I'm like, this music shouldn't be this loud. What's going on these kids these days? And then, you know, it turns out it's intentional. Maybe I shouldn't blame the manufacturer. Maybe that's just my problem. Yeah.
Well, he's non-traditional. He doesn't care. He's going to do his own thing.
That's right.
He doesn't care about the established norms. So, okay. Let's talk about performances. Amazing. Like we've talked about, I think, Anthony, what did you say? 130%?
Yep.
It's fantastic. So let's start with dialogue, and we'll start with one, because we always like to pull out like favorite lines of dialogue. Talked about one or two of them already, but Anthony, we'll start with just one other line of dialogue that you thought was significant or that you really liked.
I believe we did. It's a great way to end the movie. I mean, it's just a really haunting way to conclude this movie. You know, it's just one of those deals where it showcases,
I know what he's talking about,
how haunted that this guy is, and now we have to live in this world with his scientific discovery, and we are so close to the doomsday clock at all times. Like, our mutually assured destruction is like what keeps us from destroying each other. And it's, you know, the lasting legacy of this story is something that we're just going to be with for forever.
So, Corey, why don't you jump in? Give us one of your quotes.
So here's the thing. I'm going to point this out because it's the guy. He was a bastard. Strauss. But here's the thing. Robert Downey Jr. delivers this line, and I was going to text you guys if you caught it, and I didn't want to because then I thought you might steal and it would steal my thunder. And when Strauss meets, how am I saying it wrong, Chris or Craig? What?
It's pronounced Strauss. And I'm quoting him every time I say that, because he does that the first time, because that's Strauss. Who his character is.
When he meets Oppenheimer at Einstein, and Oppenheimer rubs him wrong by saying, oh, so he's just a lowly shoe salesman. And then Robert Downey Jr. says, a shoe salesman. A little indignant about it.
Oh, no.
You could tell he was offended. Now, you fast forward to the end, Robert Downey Jr. is plotting to take him down and to remove him of his security clearance, paying him as a communist, even though he knows he's not. Like, all these things he's planning on doing. And he says, I spent my entire life trying to build up here to get into the president's cabinet, and they want to send me back to be a lowly shoe salesman. He uses the line that he hates the most, that Robert or Oppenheimer said to him. And I don't know, did anybody else catch him say that? Or am I the only one that saw? It was a powerful moment of looking and saying, at that moment, I knew he was lying in this whole thing. He was playing this all set up. And then when the kid comes and talks to him afterwards and says, you let me talk about this and playing all this. And he goes, I'm just playing the game. And I was like, man, this is the dirt. This is the dirtiest of Washington politics. And you find out, oh my gosh, it's still going on back in World War II. We're not innocent to this. Like this dirty handed, like I'm going to take somebody down simply because I don't like him and I got a grudge and everything. And it's terrible. Don't even care about security. This guy's one of the most brilliant minds since Einstein, and we can't have him doing anything because you know what? I don't like him. And so I think it was a powerful moment in that, and it ties the two parts of the movie together. It's the payoff, Craig, is what I like to think. The payoff from a two hour gap there. They set it up with that line, lowly Sioux salesman, and then bring it back later to quote it.
Yeah, there's lots of rhyming dialogue. That was my big thing, and I'll let Justin go here in just a second, but without giving one. But the tons where it's referenced back and forth. So, Justin, did you have one that you wanted to?
I have three. Can I do three? I'm going to do three.
Sure, all why right. not?
So,
it's that good.
Strauss. I mean, there's so many. Like, I have like 30 here. I'm not even kidding. Strauss says, genius is no guarantee of wisdom.
Ooh.
Love that. Mm-hmm. I know so many stupid, smart people. Not so many. I don't have highfalutin friends. Sorry, Craig. End quote. No, but like I feel like we've all met that guy that is just like an absolute genius, but has zero common sense. Mm-hmm. So that really hit me. The other one, my other two are, I don't know, funnier. The other one was Leslie Groves, Matt Damon, who they're talking about the near zero chance of catching the atmosphere on fire, and he's like near zero chance, like near zero. Zero would be nice. Like,
that's a real thing, by the way.
Yeah, this was a real concern.
That was a real concern. Like, I this love could that. Nuke the atmosphere.
In a movie with not a lot of levity, that is absolutely a nice little breath of fresh air. And I love that even though that was in the trailer, it didn't spoil it for me when it happened in the movie.
It was great. The other one I loved, and I couldn't find the exact line. I was just trying to look for it, and I couldn't find it. But essentially, when Oppenheimer meets Strauss for the first time, and it talks about how... Oh, I understand self-made man. Oh, are you a self-made man? He's like, no, but my father was. Like, that's not self-made. That's totally different. I love that. So many good ones.
So a couple of I'm going to throw out two rhyming ones and I'll come back around at the second time because it is so sneaking quotable, actually. But two of the ones I really like, who'd want to justify their whole life, is said by Strauss, describing Oppenheimer security hearing, but also repeated back to him almost immediately after that by his Senate aide, by Han Solo. And then the other one is, they're kind of like the parallels of each other. First, Bohr says it to Oppenheimer, and then vice versa later on. It says, you can lift the stone without being ready for the snake that's revealed, and then later you can't lift the stone without being ready for the snake that's revealed. Interesting, because they have contrasting views on that, but so Oppenheimer's a little bit more ready to jump in than Bohr was.
I got one I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with Oppenheimer making a comment. He was talking to, I can't remember which one of the scientists it was, but he says, I don't know if we can be trusted with such a weapon, but I know the Nazis can't.
Mm.
And I feel like you kind of summarized, why was this made? Why did we make this? Well, I don't know if we can be trusted, but I know those guys over there cannot be trusted. So I think that's a powerful... that's a slap of reality that these guys had to live in.
And that's how a lot of them justified it too. Yeah. Why they're working on such a project.
Yeah, it they're in such an impossible situation of, if we don't, someone else will.
And here's the interesting thing too that I've learned in the interim is that Japan was also working on their own atomic project too at the same time. Like,
interesting. Yeah.
So it's interesting how they were so willing to use it against the Nazis, but then as soon as the war ends with Germany, that they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to use it against the Japanese anymore. It's like, well, maybe if they knew, or perhaps they did know, I don't know how much they were aware of Japan's own atomic program at the same time. Again, history's 2020, but,
Maybe this is the benefit of, you know, hindsight, but I feel like it's also a lot easier to make the case that, you know, the Nazis are the bad guy. That is like a morally, like unobjectively wrong moral evil, whereas like Japanese is more of like a, I don't know, political difference. I don't know what you'd call that.
I would say an ideological difference.
There we go. Yeah, ideological difference. Yeah, you can make the case against the Nazis much easier, I feel like.
Right.
Well, and I think that's where the comment he has with Niels Bohr pays in. Like, is it big enough? And then Oppenheimer says to end the war, and Niels Bohr says to end all war.
Yeah.
And I feel like, okay, they did target the Nazis with this. That's who it was. But then they still had a war going on, and they used it to end the war. And their thought was this would end all wars, because if you have this.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that's the punishment he gives himself later with everything afterwards. So,
well, to that point, I will say, you know, if you look at the number of, you know, we've had conflicts and wars since World War II. But if you look at the number of, you know, deaths since World War II, that number is infinitely less than, you know, the first half of the century.
Right.
Yeah.
So whatever world we created post World War II, it's madness how this mutually assured destruction has kept us in some weird semblance of peace.
I wonder if just during the Cold War, like I'm sure there are interviews that we could look up, but just how Oppenheimer was feeling. I wonder if he's just like, you know, could have been much worse. Could be much worse. Like, we're doing pretty good.
Well, and I here's my last quote. I mean, because there's so many powerful quotes that come out of this that about the horrificness of this. But Albert Einstein's quote at the end, and I don't know if that's a true thing that Albert Einstein told him this, but he said, when they punished you enough, they'll serve you salmon, potato salad, make speeches, give you a medal, pat you on the back for telling you all is forgiven. Just remember, it won't be for you. It would be for them. And that's how the movie ends, with him getting told this, you know, and all of this is happening. He's at a state dinner. He's getting an award. They're patting him on the back, and they're doing all that. And his wife refuses to shake that one scientist's hands who turned against him. Like, all of this. And I feel like, man, if that's not just how he accomplished all this and lived all this and had to endure all this, but at the same time, the corruption and disgustingness of politics in Washington, you know, it's amazing that that stuff gets done and accomplished and saves everybody. You know, we all had the same goal for peace, but then only to find out, man, we're still fighting terrible stuff at the end here in our own systems.
So we could probably, we could easily do a 3-hour episode of this, but I want to make sure we're moving. Any other things with performance, as I have a couple, just with body language, facial expressions, or costumes, hair, and makeup that you guys want to just throw out kind of rapid fire?
I think with costumes, hair, and makeup, I think movies like this that tend to span decades can sometimes overdo the aging or de-aging through practical effects on their actors. And I was happy to see that they didn't overdo it, almost to the point where I don't know which one of these actually looks like Cillian Murphy. Is it the younger one or is it the older one? The only time where I really felt like, oh, they overdid it just a little bit was right at the end when he's accepting his final award in the White House.
That's the one thing that pulls me out of a little bit.
Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of that, especially Emily Blunt. She looked a little plasticky. But the rest of it looked also natural, and I'm sure they I don't know for sure. Maybe one of you guys can correct me, but it's got to be all practical effects. I don't think any CGI was used there. Not that I could tell, at least.
It's sparing for sure.
Yeah. They did a fantastic job, and to the point you can hardly tell, if at all.
Yeah. My favorite bit of the makeup is Gary Oldman by far, because I knew he was in the film, but I did not recognize him the first time I watched the film.
Gary Oldman's in this film?
I had to go back and go, who do you play again? He plays Truman. Oh,
that was Gary Oldman?
Yeah. Yes.
Are you kidding me? No. I seriously did not know. 100%. 100%. There's like 1,000 people in this cast list. I didn't look it over.
Yeah.
What?
No. He did one day on set. That's him. Yeah, that's brilliant.
I didn't like him. He was too Gary Oldman for me. To me, it was too much.
What? He was too Gary Oldman. I didn't even know it was Gary Oldman.
He's the that guy's a chameleon. What's the most? He wasn't Sirius Black or James Gordon. Who was?
I found out like 10 years ago that he was Sirius Black. I never knew that.
No,
I was
no way. I love Gary Oldman. Churchill, he's fantastic.
Yeah, it's weird that he plays Truman and Churchill.
You know, or the dude from Air Force One. Come on. Get off my plane.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah, it was not my favorite Gary Oldman role for sure.
Well, whatever. I love Gary Oldman. A couple of things I also want to point out. I love that it's just, the more I watch this, the more I hate Jean Tatlock. Just because she's just so mean and cold and refusing to hold Oppie's hand in public. It's just rude. It is. It's just awful. But one of my favorite things is, and every time I love it so much, it's in the trailer, although we got a slightly different version in the trailer because the profanity in this one. Groves' whole body tensing up as the recruited scientists are testing his patience. And then the last one, Condon's like, why would we do it? And he's like, why? Why? Oh, because this is the most important effing thing in the whole ever happened in the history of the world. Love. He just explodes. It was like they've been showing him just getting more and more tense. Yeah. It's like, do you not understand what's at stake?
Yeah.
You're going to be inconvenienced for a little bit.
I couldn't tell if that was meant to be comedic or not.
Yeah. Oh.
But that, hey. Let's just talk about the historical aspect of that right now, because that was the genius part of this, was you can't just take these scientists away for 3 to 5 years. You got to bring their families. Yeah. You got to build a town. It even said at one point, you got a school over here. We're having 10 babies a month in this now new town that's been invented. Our own area right here has just been made with this Hanford because of this. Like this town sprouted up. And to go look at the B reactor, to go look at all the stuff that Enrique Fermi was in his office, and he's in this movie. And then, I mean, all that stuff. It's tremendous to know Los Alamos did the same thing. So, I mean, that's a genius way to do things, to pull these people from premier spots to make them do this.
And Corey, that's a beautiful segue into setting and design. Did you see what you did there? That was fantastic.
It's like you paid me, Craig.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about this is the fact that Los Alamos has actually kind of grown up, and so they couldn't film all of it there because there's like a Starbucks on the street. Mm-hmm. Although they did film like in his actual house. That's pretty great.
Oh, wow.
In Oppenheimer's house. So yeah, you have Ghost Ranch in New Mexico standing in for Los Alamos original site. But yeah, but it's filmed on location all over the place, like the Advanced Study Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where Downey comes running out, which is another thing that's kind of interesting when he comes to meet Oppenheimer. Like that's actually there, and Berkeley is Berkeley in Pasadena. So that also adds to the realism of this. I mean, they built lots of stuff clearly, but they also were, let's just go to the real place that's right there.
I mean, that just adds to like, I don't know if I really got into this when we were talking about like dialogue, but like, it's so rare to find a historic film that is so rooted in actual history rather than having to make it up for the drama of it all. And the fact that they're actually filming in the locations of these places just continues to add to how real it is. And I attribute that to Nolan and his desire to make everything as real as possible.
And I have to say too, just like as a teacher, all the teaching scenes were things that were like things I wanted to pay more attention to. And so seeing like chalkboards and all the books and what I thought was interesting, like his classroom setup, like where the chairs are in a circle instead of in rows or in table groups or what have you, was like, I would never do that with middle schoolers because I couldn't see the kids behind me. But that's, it's a totally different thing. The way he's bringing them in together. And I love how they do that with the editing too, where it's like he's talking to one guy and then it cuts to him, cuts back, and then it's more people. Cuts to him, then back and forth to see the classroom building out that way.
I was so jealous of how engaged those students were.
They wanted to be there, Justin.
They wanted to be purpose. There learning about that.
Yeah, what's that about?
Yeah, well, was it a tutelage seminar to start or something like that?
Yeah, it was like one guy. That was fantastic.
Makes me sad.
So, Justin, I really want you to talk about one of the most important props in this film. And that is the apple, because you talked to me today at lunch about something that you had noticed and or heard about why the apple that he put cyanide in was so important.
Yeah, had an epiphany in the way that apples tend to do that to people, famously. But
Isaac.
Thank you, Corey. Yeah, Isaac.
Sir Isaac. His name is Sir. Thank you very much.
That was a deep joke for you intellectuals out there. just kidding. No, I felt like the Apple was so interesting. Fair amount of like foreshadowing and like a microcosm of what was going to happen to Oppenheimer throughout the whole thing. He kind of got it in his head that he hated this teacher, and he injected some cyanide into that apple. He made it essentially a weapon of destruction. And then he spent the rest of the evening regretting that decision and quickly trying to take it back. And he was able to take it back. Whereas with the bomb, created this weapon, can't take it back. It's done.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Boom. When you do stuff like that, you make me like this movie more. Shame on you.
Well, hopefully that's what's happening. When you find out that
Gary Oldman's actually in this movie.
Yeah. And Gary Oldman. Like, I start making me go and say, you know, that's kind of stuff I didn't catch the first. This, you know, if I watch this 3-4 more times, I might catch these things. Doggone it.
Corey, I would like to start making a graph and just like a bullet graph of when you get excited in our podcast. This is probably the latest.
This
you get
the
to
moment.
This moment where
it
you
is.
Just go,
an hour in. And
I feel like the last few movies have been this, where I have not been excited about the movie. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be the guy on here talking bad about it. Because usually we agree on everything. But now I'm like, oh. And then I get some moment like this where Justin goes and says, you know, the allegory of everything. And I'm like, oh, that's okay. Now it clicks. And I'm like, wow. It's like an apple fell on my head, Justin, just right there. Yeah. Let me know. So
I also like, I don't know if it's intentional, but the line where he says wormhole. I don't know if that's is that a science joke?
It's like physicist it a joke.
I think
the wormhole took the apple away.
Yeah.
He was making a weird joke to try and pound it off. That's what I thought.
And does anyone else just constantly see Niels Bohr as like Gilderoy Lockhart? Like, I can't see him as anything else.
See, I think he's an underrated actor. I love
him. He really is. And director, too.
Yes, yeah, Kenneth Branagh is fantastic.
He's great.
Another Nolan veteran for sure.
Yeah.
One character I got to talk about, I got to bring in there, is Enrico Fermi taking bets on whether or not the atmosphere destroys everybody.
The side bets.
That was
a real thing.
A real thing. And
not sure how you're going to collect on that bet, but sure.
It's a different aspect to see Enrico Fermi, because he did come to Hanford, and I've been on this reactor tour out here. And you go and you tour this nuclear reactor, and there's a spot where they would put the rods in there, and they were supposed to fission and create nuclear energy, and they didn't. And Enrico Fermi went into this office. They have it all monument, you know, museum-like, and he went in there with his slide ruler, ran calculations, comes out, resets things, and then all of a sudden the nuclear reactors are working. And the part that it always makes it stand out while I'm watching this movie is how – intellectual these guys are, and these equations and what they're looking at and thinking about, and the numbers, that there is just a next level to these people that we have no, how do you make these normal actors act like this, to sound like this, and to pull this off, and still, you know, I mean, let's be honest, you have to dumb the science down a little bit so the common person like me can watch this, you know. But you kind of don't want to, because you're like, these people are intellectual and superheroes in this realm of creating this type of stuff, that they had to be highlighted and held up to a pedestal to say, this intelligence, you know, single-handedly helped lead to the end of the war. So, I mean, it's an amazing thing. So like Enrico Fermi there, I hear that name and I like it, because I'm like, oh, it's a guy that's local for us. So,
yeah, anytime they're writing math equations, I'm just like, I don't even know what half those characters are.
Yeah,
you're a math teacher, Corey. Tell us, do the math thing.
I'm going to tell you right now. I checked out when I saw some of those equations on the board. I was like, you know what? It's like a Big Bang Theory. Yes, those are real equations up there, but they mean nothing.
You should just mess with your kids one day and just have a math equation like that on the board, and when they come in, just be like, solve it up there.
Hey, solve it. What? They all look at it and laughed in the movie. I don't understand how in the movie they're all sitting in those little. It's like this office that was built for them. They're all on these wood chairs. It does not look comfortable. Yeah. And they're always talking about dropping the marbles in there for how much plutonium is being made, how much uranium is being made. That office does not look inviting. It's like a staff meeting of the greatest minds in the world.
Right.
And they're on wood chairs. Nobody's leaning back. I mean, it's just – it was a very different generation to live that way.
We're so
soft.
And
I tell you what, like, that wasn't – I don't know if that happened or not, like, the actual marbles – But like, that's for us at home, the audience. That's the way to tell us how close they are to they're being building. Finished they're or not. We don't know any other indicator. Like, we don't get the math. Like, I wish I knew what E=MC² really means. I couldn't even tell you. Or how to calculate it.
But I'll tell you this. That's exactly what the marbles are for, because the equation was probably written on the board, how close they were all the time, and none of us could get it. So like, well, we got to put some marbles here so people can understand it. Because I guarantee you those scientists knew.
I imagine they had a guy on set that's just like, okay, you are our official dumb down person. Just make sure the normies can understand this stuff.
Give them a shot at it.
Well, Nolan wrote it, so I guess he must have became an expert to some degree in some of this stuff to even write about it to some degree to begin with.
Yeah.
But then to be one of us basically, and then having that in already is a lot easier, I guess, than the other way around, because you saw some of these scientists, at least the way they're portrayed in this, they couldn't talk to real people at all.
Yeah.
Well, I do think he probably pulled a lot of it from the book, but there would have had to have been some level of understanding to know what to pull from the book and what not to.
Yeah. Any other characters we should highlight?
Well, I'm a little sad to see that Han Solo, I'm not even going to pronounce his name, Alden
Ehrenreich.
And yeah, he's not a named character. He's Senate aide.
Yeah.
Is he the young guy who at the end, Roppenheimer, he kind of tells him playing the game?
He was Strauss's aide.
Yeah, he's like, I bet they were talking about something a little bit more important.
Yeah.
Oh, and that was a great scene too, because I also liked that Louis Strauss got his comeuppance right there.
Mm-hmm. It showed his real hand, his narcissism. Like, I mean, it was all there, always there throughout. Like, when you watch it on subsequent viewings, you're like, yep, that was there.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to be Robert Downey Jr. and not play a narcissistic character, though. He kind of always comes off that
pulls,
way.
Yeah, pull from what you know.
Yep.
I hate to hate Robert Downey Jr. That's
I was going
to
say...
I like him so much.
Rami Malek playing David Hill, like a best actor winner, just having like almost no dialogue until the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Wild to begin with. I was like, they didn't just cast Rami Malek just to be a pushover in a scene.
Yeah.
And then to come in and just give almost the death blow to his, Senate or approval hearing. Great way to build up the story up to that point too.
It was strange how many big actors had such small roles.
It was certainly one of those movies where you're like, oh, it's that guy. It's that guy. It's that guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The one character I got to point out for Strauss, this may be his redeeming quality. Okay. And I don't know if I can redeem him, because he was such a bastard in this movie, is at the end when he was mad and upset, he lost his post and he was ranting about Oppenheimer, and he says he made him a martyr. And he says Oppenheimer should be thanking him, because his name is not attached to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but instead it's attached to Trinity and the science. And he will be remembered for his science, and people will be sympathetic towards him for his science, not for what the destruction that it cost, and that he should be thanking him. Like me looks and goes, well, there's a little bit of truth to that statement if you want to look at it from Strauss's perspective, that, you know.
And historically, I would argue it's correct, too.
Yeah. He's remembered for the science and not the destruction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he's very much seen as like a tragic character. I can't think of any time where I've seen him portrayed as a villain. I feel like history has been very kind to him.
Is there a hero's journey in this? I'm not the hero's journey expert.
Oh, let's see. There would have had to have been some sort of reluctance to the call. And I believe he was. I mean, I don't feel like it fits Hero's Journey super well, but you could probably shoehorn it in there.
Yeah, death, I don't know if he definitely, I don't know if he had a reluctance to joining. He was certainly willing to join.
would you call the guy a hero? I mean, he's...
Depends on your point of view, I think.
here's the thing that I noticed about Oppenheimer. When he meets, and Cillian Murphy does this brilliantly, throughout the whole movie, he is the most confident person and speaking on a different level. It's like the guy operates on a different plane. You get him into Harry Truman's office, the president's office, he is now all of a sudden stammering and kind of a little bit nerdy, to the point like backed off, like, oh my gosh, where'd Oppenheimer go? Who's this guy? You know, he looks like him, but he does not sound confident like him. He's stammering a little bit, and he makes the comment, I have blood on my hands. It's like at that point, he reigned. It's whether he got hit with the levity, the whole heaviness of the situation, what he's done. But I felt like it was a different shift for him mentally to go from I'm the guy that got us all there to I'm the guy that created this weapon. So, I mean, I thought that was a well done kind of point to point that out. So he has regret. I don't know if it's a hero story, but it's definitely it's a biographical thriller of it.
I mean, it's one of the few times he shows vulnerability in this movie. And, you know, I don't know if what he really wanted in that conversation. Did he want absolution from the president? Someone to say, like, you know, basically what he told him, I dropped the bomb. It's not your problem.
Maybe say it in a nicer way, though.
Yeah, like be a bit more kinder instead of, you know, coming in there and, you know, when he's like, we need to have arms talks, like eventually the Soviets will get it. It's illogical to think otherwise. They have good scientists and abundant resources. Like, it's going to happen. You know, maybe if that conversation went differently, perhaps, I don't know, history probably would have ended up the same way. But it is a powerful sign of vulnerability that he doesn't really show to other people throughout this. He's always the confident one that can walk between both worlds, right? That's why he's like, I can't run a hamburger stand, but I can go between nuclear physicists and the military and be that in between that is needed to get this project done.
I thought that was really cool to see, too. Like, it almost like was a testament to show how much Oppenheimer was able to get done because he wasn't bogged down by the politics of it. He wasn't bogged down by the capitalist or communist viewpoints. He was purely in it for the science. They kept talking about how he was such a great American, but I don't even know that it ever really showed that he was invested in America. He wasn't invested in anything else either, but if anything, he was just more invested in the science, and that's mm-hmm. really all he cared about. But because of that, he was able to complete his goal quite a bit easier, and he kind of makes mention of that early on about how Hitler didn't really want to look into it too much because it was Jewish science, and you know the racism held him back.
Yeah. Well, about some final thoughts, we kind of wrap up. I'm going to go with this. I'm going to say you guys have convinced me this was a great movie. I thought it was a good movie. I've been here thinking, okay, there's a lot more things that I need to pick up. I may have to give it a second watch. I will think my final thought would be with this. Oppenheimer is a guy who basically called Einstein past his prime in this movie.
He did.
Because he says, when they say he's the greatest mind of all time, and Oppenheimer says greatest mind of his time, and that was 40 years ago. And that's like the gall on you to flat out just say that Albert Einstein, you know, maybe this is where the joke started from that we all use when someone does something stupid. Now we call him Einstein, is that Oppenheimer might have started that, like just saying, oh, nice smooth move, Einstein, you know, kind of thing. Because he did. He called him past his prime, I think, in this movie.
But then Eisenhower pushes back on him and says, it'll happen to you, too.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll be serving you potato salad and salmon and patting you on the back.
And he knew. He knew. At that point, he was old. But so it was. It's a great movie. It's a great movie. Powerful, tremendous topic that I think there's more movies to come around this era. And so it's definitely worth a watch and a discussion with some friends.
Here's some of my final thoughts. It's the second highest grossing R-rated film of all time behind Joker, which is kind of an interesting. I was like, well, behind what? Oh yeah, Joker. That's weird. Highest grossing biographical film of all time, surpassing Bohemian Rhapsody. And a way better film than that. Good to six. But what I really want to talk about is, because again, it's kind of our Oscar preview show. What do we think it's going to win? First off, it won 5 Golden Globe Awards, which is oftentimes the precursor for what wins an Oscar, right? So it won Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Director for Nolan, Best Actor for Cillian Murphy, Best Supporting Actor for Downey, and Best Original Score for Goranson. It has been nominated for the Oscars, it's been nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, this time Emily Blunt. Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Original Score, Best Sound, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, Best Haircut, Makeup and Hairstyling, rather, Best Costume Design,
Best Haircut,
and Best Film, Best Haircuts, Best Film Editing. But here's the thing, not for visual effects, which is laughable, in my opinion. So, how many is he going to pull? What do you guys think?
I mean, most importantly, I think the real win there was it won Corey's heart.
It did. It warmed my heart, my cold heart.
I have to say, right off the top, I think it's a travesty that Damon didn't get nominated for Best Supporting Actor as well. Because I know Downey's got the cachet, and I love him in this, and I really do hope that he wins it. I think it's well deserved.
Yeah,
I think he will too. I think people love Downey. The story, all of it. They just love him. But both of those, anytime he and Cillian Murphy are in scenes together, and he and Damon, Cillian Murphy and Damon are together, they're equal for me. Like, they're both just such good pairings. So I love them both. But yeah, I mean, if I had to pick one, I guess I'd pick Downey just as kind of the sentimental favorite.
Craig, what's the record for most wins? I know it's Return of the King and Titanic that are tied, I think.
That's a good question.
I think they have 8, if I'm not mistaken. See, 8 I don't or think 7. It's more. I hope it's more, because, I mean, both of those are good movies. Deserve their flowers. But I got to think that it's probably going to be a little less than both of those. But I think it's going to be high. It's going to do very well this coming, March 10th.
So 10. 10. Hold on a second. No, 11. I'm sorry. 11. So 11. Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur, 1950, great film. Yeah, Return of the King and Titanic each received 11 Oscars. So I would be shocked if it won more than that. But
yeah,
long movies tend to win 16 a lot of Oscars.
Like that
13. 13. But again, not for visual effects, which, that's whatever. Crazy. What were you watching?
Yeah.
Well, I
appreciate the fact that as spectacularly visual as it is, and it is special effects laden, that it's the acting and the directing that is being lauded. So
I think that's pretty spectacular. I do spend a lot of my time watching films that are nominated in preparation so that I feel like I have an opinion when it comes to what is nominated and what is going to win.
Yeah.
And what should win. So I'm part of those conversations when they come up.
Yeah.
I am a little disappointed about the visual effects portion. I think a nomination would be great. I think that Godzilla Minus One is going to win just for how it looks based off of the budget that it had, which is astounding. Yeah. I think that somewhere around 7 to 8, if I'm going to be honest there. I definitely think it's a lock for Best Picture Director. Cillian Murphy is going to win for Actor. Robert Downey Jr. is going to win for Supporting Actor. So that's 4 right there.
Yeah.
He could very easily win a couple more. Score, certainly. Score is going to win. So that's 5 right there.
I would hope so. Yeah.
So it's going to clear house. Well, let's just say that. It's going to win more than anything else on March 10th. So by a long shot. And it certainly deserves it.
It is a great film. Like, we watch a lot of movies, and I enjoy movies for different reasons, different types of movies, but this was a great film, and I don't use the word lightly.
I'll say nothing wrong with popcorn films, but this isn't one where you can just sit and turn your brain off. Like, this is an engaging piece.
Yeah, that's what Corey said. Like, you have to be emotionally invested to watch this movie. Not just the 3 hours, but also, like, it's going to be
You're gonna think about it afterwards. Like,
yeah,
you're gonna
put your phone away, man. Come on.
Well, that's the thing about movies nowadays, with us not watching movies into theaters, but being released to streaming or just going to the streaming mentality of I'll wait till it comes out on streaming. Is you are not when you go to the theater, you are invested. You have to turn your phone off because, I mean, you can't. How dare you? And you're gonna be sitting there with a pop and a couple candy bars and some nachos. Just invested in watching the movie. That's what you're doing. And you catch those things.
So, Corey, you're just the master of segue tonight, because it made me think of it. So Anthony had a series on movie etiquette that I thoroughly enjoyed for Force Ghost Conversations. And so I'm going to plug that as I transition into having Anthony plug what's going on with his show. Talk about that and then whatever else you got going on with your show before we let you get out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of my movie etiquette must-dos, in my opinion, are you sit in the theater, you are quiet. Don't have conversations with people. Turn your phones off. You don't need to be texting people or checking your Instagrams, your Snapchats. You don't need to Snapchat while you're in the theater, too, to tell people you're there. Just Just let it go. You're there to watch a movie. You paid for it for the most part. Like, you paid for this experience. I can't believe that people, like, if you're at home, by all means, do whatever you want. I don't have a problem with that. But when you're, you know, I think I'm under the belief that your rights end where someone else's begins in many contexts. And the movie theater is one of those where if you're, the way you're enjoying a movie ends how I'm enjoying a movie. Like, that's where the gray area is. So just, like, be kind to others. Be quiet. Turn your phones off. Don't have conversations. Leave the cinema if you need to have a conversation, right? Like, don't take a phone call while you're in the movie, which people have done the last 2 years for me, which are blows my mind that people would even just do it. Come on, guys. Be better. Be better.
I don't think, like, having taught the Bill of Rights for a couple of years now to students, I don't think I've ever heard that phrase used in the context of a movie theater. But
now you can, Justin.
I like it. I like it.
There you go.
I agree,
do that with kids sometimes, too. I'm like, I don't get
Craig,
it.
Craig, I think we talked about this. Like, there should be a code of conduct at the start of every movie that, like, you are told the rights that you have at the cinema. Like, you're here to enjoy. You're here to have fun. You're not here to do X. And as soon as you do X, those are bounds for expulsion. But I know those kids that are running the theaters, the poor kids making minimum wage, aren't going to come in there to kick kids out. Like, they don't have that really authority, nor do they care really. Well, but it does ruin the theater experience for people, which is sad. Like, I go to the cinema maybe once every 2 weeks. So it, you know, it does just degrade sometimes my experience for films I'm looking forward to going to see.
I met the Wrath of Craig once for, I believe it was the Joker. I was talking too much during the Joker, and afterwards Craig's like, "Man, that Justin guy never shut up." I'm like, "Sorry, Craig."
I blocked it out until just now, Justin.
Hurt my feelings.
So, Anthony, what's going on with the show? What are you guys doing on Force Ghost Conversations right now?
Well, before we get into that, I'd like to just talk a bit more about this movie if I can.
No, that's fine.
I wanted to have my soapbox for a bit.
No, you're fine. Movie. I just want to make sure you get an opportunity to plug. So
yes, of course. Go for it. So like I said, this movie it transcends art because it's a way that we can have these conversations, and it brings up the importance and pivotal nature of why we should be careful of those that do have access to nuclear power, nuclear armament. International talks and, you know, peace conversations should always be at the forefront of our thinking whenever we're doing actions. Unfortunately, we live in a world now where these weapons do exist, but it was something that was going to happen regardless because every country was pushing towards they were going to get it, you know, whether it's Nazi Germany, whether it was someone else, the Soviet Union. Right. That's just the unfortunate nature. And, you know, we got to it first, which is a really astounding scientific achievement. But as this movie talks about, it's that horrific, yet also it's the duality of scientific achievement. Right. In the right hands, it's a deterrent. But in the wrong hands, it creates a world ending destructive machine. And, you know, the teller piece of it all where he's like, until someone builds a bigger bomb. Right. We just keep outgrowing each other and keep. It's just human nature to keep building something bigger than the last guy. And you know, we're on this constant endless cycle where we're hoping that we elect good leaders and that people are in good positions to make diplomatic relations. And we're just always one tick away from the doomsday clock going off and the world going to all oblivion. So this movie just, again, brings out those questions and conversations. And, you know, I am a student of history myself. I had multiple family members. My grandparents served in World War II. They were in the European theater. This movie, again, brings out those great debates of should we have used the atomic bombs? And I think for all of us on this call, as Americans, we would probably say unequivocally, yes. We had to do it. Otherwise, right, we had to exhaust all options if we could have before invading Japan. The invasions of Peleliu, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa as precursors to the invasion of Japan showcased that the Japanese defense was going to be stout, and women and children were being trained to be a part of the homeland defense. And who knows how long that the war would have lasted and the death toll that would have regarded on both sides. I don't think it's hyperbole to suggest that if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, like, the Japanese culture may not exist in the way that we have it today. We may have only a handful of Japanese, cultural Japanese people if we had gone through with Operation Downfall, the invasion of Japan.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's that really hard question of, is one life versus five lives, right? It's such, and the after effects of the bomb are just horrendous, right? You see the images and the horror stories that people had. I'm going to share a full like list of like after material that I think people that are listening should review to just educate ourselves more on this topic. From the Japanese perspective, from our perspective, from all multiple perspectives of just about the Pacific War in general, we've talked about it's a war of ideology in the Pacific. The Japanese philosophy at the time was they'd rather die in combat than surrender. That's the enemy we were up against. They were willing to take 10 lives before dying themselves in various cases. Like that's the mode that they had at Iwo Jima, which is where we had more casualties than the Japanese did. And it took 36 days to capture 8 miles of land on that little island in the Pacific that no one's heard of until we invaded it. It just brings up these horrific conversations that just need to be had because we live in this post Hiroshima and Nagasaki world. And fortunately, those are the only two times that we have dropped these weapons. And I hope that we never drop them again. And I hope that, you know, we keep having sane people in charge of these important weapons and people that are doing diplomatic work across the globe as more countries either get nuclear power or we can remove our nuclear arsenals and all that stuff. Of course, we don't live in a Cold War anymore, but of course, any country at any time could deviate from that plan and we're off on this different, different case. But I will say the only piece of this is an astounding fact here, too. I'm going to just share some amazing facts I've learned just by looking into this story. Only 2% of the uranium in the little boy atomic bomb that dropped on Hiroshima worked. So the bomb was only 2% effective, and 80,000 people died instantly with that bomb. That is a true fact. It was only 2% effective. Could you imagine if it was 10%, 20%, 50%? These weapons are incredible. And now we have even more destructive weapons, right? They show in the movie, you know, the H-bombs, right? How big of a big city killers they are, right? And then Strauss is like, go draw some of those on our side versus Moscow, right? That's the mutually assured destruction world that we live in these days. And then that's why I think Oppenheimer is so haunted by his work is like, I've created, you know, the Prometheus aspect of it all. I've given them the power to destroy themselves. And his whole purpose afterwards is to say, how can we, like, arms talks? We need to have discussions about this. We need diplomacy. Like, this is what I recommend. It's going to happen. They're going to get it. We can't keep just outbuilding each other and building up our arsenals and saying, I have more than you, and that's why you're not going to attack me, right? We need to rely on communication and focus on that and do the best we can to avoid anything at all possible that would lead to such a fact of our the annihilation of humanity, if you will. The other important stat that I want to share with you all that it's really, really powerful as to, like, you know, for Americans at least, I've shared the expectation was 5 million Japanese people were expected to die because of, you know, and our projections of if we invaded Japan. They were expecting 1 million American soldiers, 1 million American soldier casualties if we had invaded Japan through Operation Downfall, both parts of the operation. The Purple Heart Order that we did in anticipation of that invasion, we are still giving out Purple Hearts from that order, that original order in 1945 to soldiers that are injured in the battlefields these days. So that just goes to show you like what carnage we've avoided because of these atomic bombing droppings. And frankly, those are all the details that I need in order to say justify the usage of these weapons, however horrible they are. But it is that catch-22 of we have used them. Now we can hopefully try to do everything we can to learn from the events and to hopefully never have to deal with another nuclear weapon dropping again. Hopefully that is something that a world that our we don't live in, our children don't live in, our children's children don't live in. That's the only thing that I hope that we can really take away from this movie and continue to have conversations about how important it is to be thinking about that and top of mind as we move forward into the future. So just like I mentioned, some final thoughts, not really final thoughts, but just like this movie is just one side of it all. It's very much Oppenheimer's perspective, right? You see him looking at the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We don't see the actual photos and all that stuff. So I would definitely recommend listeners, if you want to explore the Pacific War and World War II more in general, and perhaps even the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from the Japanese perspective and what those folks went through, I would highly recommend Barefoot Gen, both the manga and the anime, which is about a kid's perspective that actually lived and survived from the Hiroshima bombing. It's not tied to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings itself, but the firebombing of Tokyo is discussed in the film Grave of the Fireflies, which is a really horrific and horrendous piece of anime. Godzilla Minus One, it's a wonderful movie that came out this past year, but it talks about the psychological impact of the aftermath of World War II, especially with that Godzilla motif being a creature created as a result of the atomic weapons. The documentary that you can find on HBO, White Light, Black Rain, is really, really powerful and a great way to just learn more about both sides, the American and Japanese perspective in regards to the aftermath of the atomic bombings. The book Hiroshima by John Hersey is also a very powerful story about survivors. I definitely would recommend anybody to check out the book American Prometheus, the inspiration novel for Oppenheimer, if you want to just dive into, I think it's like over 1,000 pages long. So if you really want the deep dive into everything, I definitely would recommend that. Just some more, I think it's very important to understand how different the psychology and ideology of the Pacific War compared to what was going on in Europe is to why the atomic bombs were dropped in the beginning. So I would recommend someone read With the Old Breed at Peleliu and Okinawa by E.B. Sledge, who's also featured in the HBO miniseries The Pacific. It's a great way to kind of dip your feet into how horrendous the Pacific War actually was. I think Tora 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 is a great film depicting the events of Pearl Harbor. Letters from Iwo Jima, a great movie that showcases the Japanese perspective in some of the later battles of World War II. And just some final books, The Rape of Nanjing by Iris Chang and War Without Mercy by John Dower showcases how racism was such a pivotal aspect of creating the differences between just the Japanese and other aggressors, if you will, in the Pacific that they were fighting against, which led to so much of the great carnage that resulted in the Pacific War. So that is all of my really final thoughts and soapbox about this movie and why I think it's so important for people to watch and to learn and to debate and to understand, as it's not just a piece of good film, which it is, but it is a film that invites conversation and it asks us to look inward and think about these important questions. So I hope that the listeners do spend some of their time in the next couple of days contemplating these important topics. But anywho, on the other side of things, I do.
Thanks for sharing your passion, Anthony. Yeah,
I do
for sure.
Host a Star Wars podcast called Force Ghost Conversations, where weekly we discuss all the things in regards to Star Wars. Sometimes we touch into the Lucasfilm galaxy side of things, so Indiana Jones and Willow and whatever else they may do in the future. So if you're into all that and you like deep dive, cozy discussions, that is your place for that. So we're currently doing Bad Batch discussions right now as season 3, the final season of Bad Batch, is premiering on Disney Plus. So every Sunday we have a new episode based off of what came out on Wednesday on Disney Plus. So you can find us on all of the podcast sites, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We're there. Just search for Force Ghost Conversations and you'll find us in some capacity. And if you want to continue the conversation via social media, we're on Twitter, X, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Hive. Just search Force Ghost Conversations again and we'll be there in some capacity. So thank you to Craig, Justin, and Corey for having me on. I know I kind of helped to initiate this conversation as to, talking about this movie. So thanks for letting me again have this soapbox, because these are some questions and thoughts that I've been having for quite some time that, my wife Elise is thrilled that I have someone else to chat about them with rather than just sitting at the dinner table and asking her what her thoughts are on this stuff. Yeah. So.
Awesome. Yeah, it's good to have you back, Anthony. We've enjoyed every time you've been on the show, and you brought some passion for sure, and some insights for things we hadn't thought about. So we appreciate you showing up and joining us tonight. And we just want to thank everybody else for listening. And if you'd like to connect with us, you can find us on X and Facebook. Email us at readingbetweenreels@gmail.com, or you can use the SpeakPipe app on our website. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast catcher. And one last thing, our next episode will be a review of Ghostbusters Afterlife. Send us an email or voicemail about your favorite moments from Ghostbusters Afterlife, and we'll share it on the next episode.